Going to read now from 1 Peter and chapter 2. 1 Peter and chapter 2. I'm going to read from verse 11 through to verse 17. Listen to God's word. Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Submit yourself, for the Lord's sake, to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority, or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong, commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honor the king. Peter is writing to Christians in what we now call Turkey, Asia Minor. He writes the beginning of the letter greeting them as God's elect, God's chosen ones, but they've been scattered around the world. They're strangers. They don't belong. And he writes to them now in chapter 2, telling them how they are to live in this place where they find themselves. They are aliens and strangers, or foreigners and exiles. Paul is writing to them as those who live in the Roman Empire, but who find themselves as citizens of heaven, citizens of God's kingdom. How do we match up those competing responsibilities? We too find ourselves living, well, in some place on earth, don't we? In a nation. We are subjects of the Queen. We live in the United Kingdom. But we are citizens of heaven. We are subjects of the King. What is to be our relationship to human governments, to the kingdom, the nation in which we find ourselves? Well, that's the context that Peter writes to them in. That. How do they live in this way? The church at this time in Asia Minor is subject to persecution. And in the Roman Empire, there's distrust against Christians. They're not quite right. They don't do the things we do. They don't proclaim Caesar as Lord. That's what a good Roman does. Caesar is Lord. But of course the Christians have got some strange claim that goes way against that. They say that Jesus is Lord. Well, who's it going to be? And so they are slandered, and they're misunderstood, and they're accused of wrongdoing. How are they to respond to that? As we read that passage together, I hope you noticed that there were some words that recurred. There was this ongoing emphasis on doing good as against doing wrong. So abstain from sinful desires, from doing wrong, but then live such good lives. Do good. That even though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see you're actually doing good deeds. And then the king, the emperor, governors, they're supposed to punish those who do wrong and commend those who do right. And you, by doing good, doing right, are to silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Don't use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Don't use it for doing wrong, but do good. Do you see that recurrence of those phrases? They're being slandered, they're being accused of wrongdoing, and the response, not throw your toys out the pram, and not to declare yourself anarchists and that you'll have nothing to do with the government. Their response is that they're called to live good lives, so that people would see their good deeds. We're told that this will silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. And we as Christian believers, we can expect to be at best misunderstood, and at worst slandered, because our ethical standards are not the same as the world. We don't run in the same way that they do. And so as Christians, we will be accused of being narrow-minded, bigoted. That we want to control other people. We want to limit them. We want to impose our way of thinking on others. We want to stop their freedoms. And our response here is to those who misunderstand, who slander us, is that in the way we live, in the good that we do, we're to answer those accusations. But here Peter tells them there to, verse 13, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men. Every human authority. Whether it's to the king, emperor, or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. Submit to human authority. To the emperor, to the king and the governors. If you read on in the chapter, into chapter 3, you come to in chapter 2 you come to a discussion about slaves and their masters. You come then to a discussion about the relationship between husbands and wives. And by verse 8, Peter sums it up by saying, finally, all of you, which is pretty all-encompassing, isn't it? We all find ourselves in human structures. So when you go to work tomorrow, you probably have a boss. And the boss tells you what you're to do. There's a structure there. Maybe some of you are in a different place in the structure. You are the boss. You tell other people what to do. Children tomorrow will go to school and there will be teachers. Over the teachers is a headmaster. He answers to governors. There's a structure in place here. In the home, the relationship between our parents and their children. In the church, the relationship between the congregation and their elders who shepherd them. Within the state, between the government and the people. Between the private soldier and his commanding officer. From the cashier in the bank to the school child and the teenager at home, there's legitimate authority. And when you were driving from here this evening, on your way back to the house, and as you go down the hill there, at the back, and you know things can run away, and the car's going just that little bit faster, and as you suddenly see in a rearview mirror these blue flashing lights, and you realize it's not Christmas. What's going on? You don't get to say, "Well, I'm not going to pull over and stop for that gentleman with police written on the front of his car because I'm a citizen of heaven." No, you don't, because we are in these human institutions, these authorities that God has placed, and we answer to them. And so these legitimate authorities, we're told, submit yourself. Be subject to these institutions for the Lord's sake. I'm going to come back to that last clause. There's something countercultural about this. This goes against the grain. Because there's something in all of us, isn't there, that says, I want to be the boss. That no one's going to tell me what to do. And we are called here to put ourselves under, to submit, to subject ourselves. What's a government for? You've just voted one in. What's it for? Did you think about that before you appointed it? Well, we're told here what a government is for, what it's to do. It's not just to make sure that the bins get emptied. But see what Peter tells us the government is for. Submit yourselves to every authority, whether to the king, the supreme authority, or to his governors, who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. That is the role of government. It is to punish those who do wrong, to restrain wickedness, and to commend those who do right, to promote what is good. We read earlier on in Rome from Romans 13, didn't we? We had a conversation. We were talking about it in our prayer meeting on a Tuesday morning. It was just 2 years ago, the last time we had an election. They seem to be coming round more often than usual at the moment. But we had this conversation, and I think it was Yvonne who pointed out this remarkable statement that the governor, the authorities, the emperor, are described as God's servant or God's minister. And we sometimes think of them as being an inconvenience or a necessary evil, perhaps. But see this, how Paul describes them as being God's servant. Again, to restrain wickedness. He is God's servant to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. And this is interesting, isn't it? I hope, dear friends, that none of you ever find yourselves in the position of being punished for doing wrong by the government. But see something else that is being said here. It is possible to be commended for doing what is right. Now, having said already that as Christians we march to the beat of a different drum, as Christians we are held by standards, we are governed in a different way, we answer to a different ruler. And yet, as Christians, by doing what God calls us to do, there is something in that. It is possible that what we do can be seen as good. There is sufficient overlap, if you like, between the morality of the world and the subject to God in his common grace and the morality of the believer. This kind of overlap means that we can be seen to do what is good by following what God says. Because it would be easy to say, isn't it, well, they just don't like it because I'm following Jesus. Jesus, remember when he speaks about at the Sermon on the Mount, he talks about, blessed are you when people persecute you because of me. Yeah. Not blessed are you when nobody likes you because you're obnoxious. Do you see the difference? A blessed when the persecution, the suffering, is on account of me. It's because of your faithfulness to me and not because you've gone your own sweet way. So it is possible to be seen to be doing good. That's not the same as doing something so you're seen to be doing good. But it's possible in doing what God calls us to do. By doing good, it's God's will that by doing good, you would silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. But here's the question I alluded to earlier, but I want to dive into here. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men. How is it that you can submit to the government, submit to the Queen, Parliament, local authorities, by extension to your boss, to the policeman who pulls you over because you were going 33 miles an hour? How is it that you could submit to government in a uniquely Christian way? Because I suspect that the person who lives next door to you, when they see the blue lights flashing in their rearview mirror, they don't say, stuff it and floor the car, do they? So in what way is your response different to their response? Well, maybe in Romans, that passage we read, Paul gave us a clue. It is necessary to submit to the authorities not only because of possible punishment, but because you know that if you drive off, the policeman will have taken your registration number and the next day they will come knocking on your door. Not because you know it will be worse for you if you do that, but also, Paul says, because of conscience. What is right? But here's Peter's summation of it. To submit yourself for the Lord's sake. To submit to government in a uniquely Christian way is to submit yourself in a way that exalts Jesus. You were called to obey the emperor in a way that honors God. Now, let me see if I can illustrate this. Suppose you work on a farm, and your job is to drive a tractor for the farmer. That's your job. And each day you turn up at the farm and you do whatever. Speak to Keith Athers, he'll tell you what he's doing with a tractor on a farm. Some days they plow, and other days they harrow, and then there's spring, and other days they harvest. But whatever it is, you do what he tells you to do, because he's the boss. But on this day, the boss says to you, "I don't want you to go out and plow that field you were expecting to do today. I want you to drive down the road to Mr. Jones's farm, and I want you to go and plow his field." And as you're ploughing Mr. Jones's field, who do you answer to? Who's in charge? That's the question we asked this morning, wasn't it? As you are ploughing Mr. Jones's field, you still answer to your boss, don't you? You're still working for them. You're only ploughing for Mr. Jones in as far as the boss wants you to plough for Mr. Jones. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every authority, to the governor, to the king. Peter's saying this. Obey the emperor in a way that honors God, because Jesus is over the emperor. Not obey the emperor because of who he is, but obey the emperor because of who Jesus is. And again, this is countercultural. This is against the grain. Because to say actually to the emperor, I'm only doing what you say, I'm only honoring you because of who Jesus is, it's going to get you killed in the Roman Empire, isn't it? That's saying again, Jesus is Lord. And then, in this remarkable statement in verse 16, Peter says, live as free men. Submit yourself to every authority. How should I do that? By living as a free person. Submit in a way that's grounded in freedom. And again, I think we need to come back and examine that again in a moment. But understand this, we put ourselves under the authorities, under the king of the government, under our queen, the emperor, whichever it is. We put ourselves under them, not because of who they are, but because of who he is. Not because they are good or worthy, but because God is. Remember that the emperor that Peter is writing about is a man called Nero. Well, there's absolutely no reason why you would honour him in his own right. He's a thoroughly wicked man. His behaviour is abominable. He is persecuting the Christians to death. They don't honour him because of who he is, but for the Lord's sake. And maybe this gives us a little bit of insight into something that Jesus says. There's a time when people come to Jesus and say they want to catch him out. What do you think then? Should we pay taxes to Caesar? And of course, in the setting, they're under Roman rule. But if Jesus is on the side of the Romans, he puts himself out with the all the people. But if he says don't pay taxes to the Romans, then he's guilty of sedition. So what's he going to do? And his answer is this. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Now, if you stop and get to the bottom of that for a minute, how do you feel at the end of the month when your pay slip comes through? And there's a line at the top. I know some of you retired, but when you get a pay slip, there was a line at the top which I thought, God, look at that. That's great, isn't it? And then you read through all the other things. And eventually there's a number at the bottom. And where did the rest go? I know it's gone. It's gone on your pension. It's gone for your national insurance. It's gone for your tax. It's gone for all sorts of deductions, for all sorts of things. But how do you feel about that number that's gone out? And honestly, most of us, I think, our inclination is to say, well, I begrudge giving that money to the government in tax, don't I? But hold on. What is it that Jesus says? Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Question for you. Which things are God's? All of them. And so when I give to Caesar, I'm not giving him out of what is mine. I am giving him out of what is God's. Do you see the difference? Now, that doesn't mean you don't get to hold a view on economic policies. It doesn't mean you don't get to consider what future governments ought to do about setting tax levels. I'm not saying that at all. Oh, we think with our minds, but our hearts, to be subject to God in this. What we give to Caesar, we are giving out of what already belongs to God. Now, live as free men, we are told. All this is to be grounded in our freedom. And again, this is radical. You see, to be a slave of Jesus means you are now free from every other authority. You put yourself in this setting. You're there. Plowing the field for Mr. Jones. You don't answer to Mr. Jones. You answer to your boss. Now, you do a bad enough job of plowing the field, and I'm sure your boss, Mr. Jones, will have a word with your boss, it'll all come back in the end. But do you see the difference? You're not working for him, you're freed. The Bible uses this kind of picture. It describes us being freed from being slaves of sin, and now being as slaves of Christ. We used to be slaves of sin, slaves of our selfish, wicked desires, and we've been set free from that. Romans 6, let me just read to you. We're described in this way. When you offer yourself to someone to obey him as slaves, you are slaves to the one whom you obey. Well, that makes sense, I suppose. You slaves to the master that you're obeying. Whether you're slaves to sin, which leads to death, or slaves to obedience, which leads to righteousness. Thanks be to God that although you used to be slaves to sin, you used to be under this master, you wholeheartedly obey. Do you see that connection to the slave is just the person they obey. You wholeheartedly obey the former teaching to which you were entrusted. You've been set free from sin and have become slaves to righteousness. You used to offer yourself in slavery to impurity and ever-increasing wickedness, and now you offer them in slavery to righteousness. You've been set free from sin and have become slaves to God. How did you get set free from sin? Have you ever thought about that? How did you get free from this slavery? have, the Bible tells us, died to your old master. When your boss comes into the office, when the sergeant major turns up on the parade ground, when the headmaster walks into the school hall, everybody jumps there. Everyone stands up straight. And now, however good a manager, however commanding a figure, however powerful a leader, if the boss goes down the road to the cemetery and starts giving instructions, everybody listens. Death cancels out the obligations of employment. And I know some of you got work in the morning. Well, there's good news. This is something to look forward to, isn't it? Death cancels out the obligation of employment. Death frees us from our old master. Paul uses that imagery. In fact, he goes on to say, look, let me explain it to you in ways that you can understand. Like this, he says, as long as you're married, the woman is bound to her husband. This is Romans 7. As long as he's alive. But if he dies, she's set free. She's released from the law of marriage. If she marries another woman while he's still alive, she's an adulteress. But if he dies, she's released from that law and isn't an adulteress. You, slave of sin, and I, slave of sin, through the union with Jesus Christ, means that when he died, we died. And so we're not slaves anymore. And now we're raised to this new life. We're not bound to anyone anymore. So that's how we're told to live as free men. Free to serve. Free to follow. Now, how's that gonna finally work its way out? Well, verse 17 is the kind of, I suppose, the practical application of it. Show proper respect to everyone. Honor everybody. That's an interesting one, isn't it? Show proper respect to everyone. Who are you going to respect? You respect the policeman comes knocking at your door. You respect your boss when you go to work tomorrow. You'll respect Mark Harper, our newly elected member, re-elected member of Parliament, next time you run across him. And you'll submit to him for the Lord's sake. You'll respect our Prime Minister and her cabinet and government. Respect everyone. You'll respect your husband, your wife. Respect your parents, your children. There's an appropriate response to be given to people. Proper respect. How do you properly honour the thief who cons the granny out of her life savings on the doorstep? Are we to rightly honour a child abuser? Because we're to show proper respect to everyone. What does that look like? Well, maybe part of it is this, is to recognize that they are made in God's image and unique and human. And to recognize that although that image is degraded and fallen, and although they sin, they are still image bearers. And maybe that's reflected in the way, as a society, we are to think about the way we deal with those who are criminals, those who offend. That they are to be punished for doing what is wrong, as governments are to do here. But principles of a fair trial and right treatment, I think, come out of this. Show proper respect, then. Honour everyone. Next, love the brotherhood of believers, or the family of believers. You see, the Christians are squeezed by Rome. Society is against them. And in that setting, they need to care for each other. There is a particular command we're given to care for Christians, to care for the church. So Galatians 6 verse 10 says this, do good to all. Especially, says Paul, to those who are of the family of believers. And Jesus' famous teaching in Matthew 25, Jesus says, well, talks about visiting the sick and giving to the poor, and as being the evidence of people seeking his kingdom. I'll read you now from Matthew 25. So, what these passages that talk about being ready for his return. And we've got this separation of the sheep and the goats. And received into his kingdom. Come, take your inheritance, prepared for you since the creation of the world. Come, why? Because I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty. I was a stranger. You clothed me. You visited me in prison. And they look at them, when did we do that? Whenever you did it, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me, says Jesus. This is not the standard that's set out here. It's not universal prison visiting or sick visiting or inviting in of strangers or feeding or clothing. That's not to say those aren't good things. That's to say that's not what Jesus is talking about here. He is talking about when you do it for these my children, these my brothers and sisters, you do it for me. And so how do we respond to the persecuted church? To love them. That's the instruction that Peter is giving here. That's how we show our affection for the king in the way we honour his servants. And so we think of the work of people like, excuse me, Open Doors or the Barnabas Fund. There are different ways we can support that. Support it financially, support it with our time. People who write letters, don't we, to those who are in prison or persecuted. But not just off there in other parts of the world. There are Christians in our own society who get squeezed. How will that play out as our society becomes increasingly secular and Christian faith is pushed increasingly into the shadows? When the Christian midwife is no longer able to not be involved in abortion. When the Christian GP is no longer able not in a position where she has to be involved in assisted suicide. How will we support those brothers and sisters on that day? Well, we're to love our family, here we're told. To respect everyone, to love the family. To fear God and to honour the king or the emperor. We don't have to fear the authorities. We're not to fear the authorities, because we're to fear God. The fear of God sets us free from the fear of man. Remember Jesus in front of Pilate, and Pilate says, look, don't you know who I am? Don't you realize what I can do to you? And Jesus' answer is, you couldn't do anything except the authority had been given to you. The fear of God sets us free from the fear of men. Well, how do we do good then? We're called here repeatedly to do good. But it needs to be overflowing. It's not lukewarm. It's not that rigid sticking to 30 miles an hour as you drive through the village so that you can somehow tick the box and say, I've submitted to the authorities. No. It's not that kind of bare minimum, lukewarm, keeping on the right side of the law. How can we do good in such a way that it would silence the ignorant talk of foolish people? How can we do good in such a way that people, even though they accuse you of doing wrong, would eventually see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits? Well, by overflowing with love towards God and the willingness to serve him and to serve others. That we ought to be a blessing to our community. That the people of St. Breville's, Tidenham Chase and Wollaston and Elwood and Bream and Chepstow, they ought to be saying, look, I don't believe what you believe. Frankly, I think you're off your head. But we are so glad you are here. That is to be the impact that Christians ought to be having in the world around them. We ought to be doing good. Maybe we need to go away and scratch our heads and work out to what extent are we doing that? How do we go about doing so? Overflowing with love towards God and towards men and women around us. And doing good in a way that would silence ignorant talk.